we have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket. We will go through both of them, and then we'll take a short break until our 10:30 docket. If the clerk will please announce the first case, Morris versus Fuller.
The court calls Francis Jane Fuller back to Morris for Lauderdale Fuller. May it please the court, Mr. Rachel Christensen will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Daniel Altman will argue for the appellate.
Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nathan Christensen. I represent the appellant in this case, Ms. Morris. Now, this case is an appeal from a trial court decision where the trial judge erred on four main issues, and I hope to be able to get to all four of them today, but we'll see. I'm going to spend a lot of my time on the first issue. The venue should have been transferred to Hemphill County, Texas, where the mineral properties in question were located, because it is subject to the mandatory venue provision. Now, the dispute all along in this case was who owned what. Even in the plaintiff's underlying suit, according to the court record, it was to recover royalties for production of oil and gas on the subject premises based on her claim to have sole ownership of the mineral property, and that the appellant, my client, was actually interfering by telling Devon Energy that she co-owned the property. So the question the entire time was, did both sisters actually co-own the property, or did just one of them own the property? Okay, so this was not just a simple contract dispute as to how much one sister owed the other or back taxes or anything. It was there ever an assignment? Did both sisters own it or did just one of them? Now, the judge actually confused the issue by stating there was really no issue as to who owned the land because the land was actually owned by the joint venture. They were co-owners of this joint venture that owned the land. And so his justification was, well, the title's not going to change because no matter what the outcome of the case, the title's going to stay the same in the name of the joint venture. And so that's how he determined that, well, there's really no mandatory venue in this case. But here's the problem with that. The joint venturers, the owners of the joint venture, are in fact the owners of the land. They're the ones that determine if they want to sell the land, if they want to make improvements to the land, basically anything like that. They are, in fact, the de facto owners of the land, and they're the ones that basically determine what is going to happen with the land because they are really the owners of the land. And
but
so that's the question.
Would your position, though, require us to then ignore the entity, the joint venture or partnership?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because the title will stay in the entity. It's going to stay in the joint venture. What we're asking is who essentially has control and who has an interest in the land. Because, for example, the actual mandatory venue provision, it's actually found in section 15.011 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. What that says is actions for recovery of real property or an estate or an interest in real property for petition of real property, remove encumbrances, for recovery of damages, or even to quiet title, all of this shall be determined or shall be brought in the county into which all or a part of the property is located.
But there's no question that the joint venture owns 100% interest in this property. Right.
They own the title, absolutely, but they don't own 100% of the interest because everybody who owns the joint venture has an interest in the land. For example, this thing is subject to a oil and gas royalty, right?
Wait, you lost me on that last sentence.
Okay. Correct.
Period. The title of the property is not in Fuller or anybody else. It's in the joint venture.
Correct.
Okay. So the joint venture owns the property, not Fuller, not anybody else.
Well, we're not talking about just the title and just the property. We're talking about the interest also to the land. In other words, the owners of the joint interest, Fuller, Morris, both of them, they're the ones that were receiving title or the actual payments for the royalty payments. Also, who gets the taxes? Who has to pay the taxes on that? The joint venture. It's the owners of the joint venture have to pay the taxes.
Is there some magical difference between a joint venture, a partnership, a sole proprietorship, a corporation owning a piece of property? Because everything you're saying is applicable to each one of those in that I own part of this entity and this entity owns the property.
Well, we're not talking about just ownership, though. We're talking about interest in the property. If all we were talking
about... What is the distinction between it being a joint venture and a corporation?
Well, no, what we're saying is if you own the corporation that owns the land, you own an interest in that land.
So if there was a dispute among shareholders of a corporation, you could say, well, if the corporation happens to own a piece of property over here, it has to be litigated in where the property is because the owners of the corporation, although it may own automobiles and railroad cars and a piece of property, it owns a piece of property, so the piece has to be litigated for the piece of property?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor.
Why not? Well, I mean, why couldn't I make the very same argument you just made?
Well, what we're talking about here is the property that is in question, okay? That question, there's no question here that the property that's in question is in Hemp Hill County, Texas. There are other parts, okay? But what the dispute is, who owns that property there? Is it just both of them, or is it just one of them under
joint venture? Joint venture owns property in Hemp Hill County and in Tarrant County.
Yes.
Okay.
In that situation, if...
We're disputing and we're arguing about who's a joint venture.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing is... There doesn't own it here in Tarrant County. There is no issue here with Tarrant County other than the plaintiff lives in Tarrant County. That's it. And they send some of the payments to Tarrant County. But the actual property under the mandatory venue provision, it says if there's an interest in real property, it shall be brought in the county in which all or part of the property is located. All or part of the property is located right there.
If there were 25 different pieces of property in 25 different counties, under your theory, we're going to have to bring the ownership question in 25 different counties because the joint venture or the corporation or the partnership owns property in that county. That can't be real. That can't be right.
Well, yeah, but I think what we're doing here is we're blowing it up into, like, you know, 26 different counties or everything. Everybody has a different interest all over the place. We're not talking about that in this case. We're talking about who owns that land in Hemp Hill County. That's all we're talking about.
We're talking about a legal principle.
We're talking about who has...
applicable to every case, and there's got to be consistency.
Surely there's some cases out there where an entity owns a piece of property, and the fight is who owns the entity. Where does it have to be brought? That's what you're saying.
Right.
If you fight about the entity, and the entity owns a piece of property, it has to be brought where the piece of property is.
Well, Your Honor, the dispute here, though, I just want to get right back to the actual central dispute, okay? And the central dispute during this entire case was who owns the land, okay? Not just who holds title to the land, because that's not just the mandatory venue. I can see how we can blow it all up, but in this case, it's actually pretty simple. We've got two sisters. One of them claims to have sole ownership. The other one claims to co-own it. That's the issue of the joint venture that owns the land. Okay, and in this thing, who owns the joint venture, who owns the land, or who gets the royalty interest? Is it just one of the sisters, or is it both of them? Both of those would fall under the mandatory venue provision. Now,
let's talk about the assignment.
Okay, you want to talk about the assignment? Were we talking about the assignment, whether or not it should be 40% or 20%? That's the third issue of mine. That one's actually very confusing. I was actually hoping to spend some time on that, so that's really good. The language in this assignment, and it is confusing, and even the judge admitted it, is that the assigner, who's my client, the appellant, shall be entitled to a 40% net profit interest in the property conveyed in the assignment. So here's how the judge figured it out. He figured, well, my client, the appellant, she only owned 50% of the property, and the appellee only owned 50% of the property. The entitlement only entitles her to 40% of the net profits that she conveyed. Okay, so she can't convey more than 50% because she didn't own more than 50%. So she gets 40% of the 50% that she conveyed. You do the math, it's 40% of 50% is 20%. That's how he came up with that. Now, here's the problem with that. As you just said, my client didn't own a thing. Okay, the joint venture owned 100% of the property. She didn't own 50% of the property to convey. She couldn't give 5%. She couldn't sell anything because she didn't own 50% of the property. The joint venture owned 100% of the property. So the property conveyed in this situation was, instead of 50% of the property, it was the entire joint venture. It wasn't just, 50% of the joint venture. It was total control. Instead of it being a joint venture, because let's face it, if this is assignment is actually valid, then there's really no longer a joint venture. So she would get total control over the joint venture. So that's what the property was conveyed, was the joint venture, and my client would be entitled to 40% of the joint venture's profits. Okay, I understand that's confusing, but here's the thing, and the reason why it's kind of confusing. Well, here's the thing. If they would have wanted it to be only 20% of the net profits, they would have put that. They would have said, look, she gets that. But instead, all they put was a 40% net profit interest in the properties conveyed in the assignment. So in other words, it's 40% of what was conveyed, and that was the joint venture. It wasn't just 50% of the profit, 50% of the property, because as you said, she didn't own 50% of the property. And the appellee's been very adamant that she didn't own 50% of the property. So that's why it would be a 40% of the total net profit of the joint venture. Okay. Now, another issue is my fourth issue, which is actually a very, very confusing one to me. Appellee claimed that she'd been making tax payments and other payments for the joint venture personally out of her own pocket since 1992, the time of the assignment. Okay. Now, the appellant actually asked for an accounting of this, and the judge actually asked for it as well. During the time of trial, but she never provided it, not during the entire time of trial. And here's the kicker. She never even asked credit for any of those payments in her pleadings. She didn't ask for any of that stuff. But for some reason, the judge gave her full credit for all the taxes that she had paid since 1992, and then he ordered her to do an accounting for all of that stuff to prove exactly how much the joint venture itself actually owes the appellee and has to pay back the appellee before my client will receive a dime. And the person that has to determine exactly who does that accounting is the appellee herself.
Right. I mean, your real point is that you can't contest her figures because you don't know what her figures are.
Exactly. And we did ask for that at trial. She never provided for it. And like I said in the pleadings, she never asked for credit for that, but for some reason the judge gave that. And so I don't think it's fair that we would have to be required to relitigate that issue. If she didn't provide it, then it's lost on her. So what we're asking for is if the assignment is upheld, that the judgment at least should be modified for a commencement date of September 11th, 2009. And that was the date of the trial court decision.
Shouldn't that portion be remanded for the trial court for the trial on that issue?
We can do that too, Your Honor. What we're asking, though, is we're asking you to determine that it's too late. She should have done that at the trial. Let's just go ahead and start the payments right now. That's what we're asking this court to do.
It sounds like what you're asking for is number one, she didn't plead it, so she waived it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a backup, you can't have sort of a unilateral prospective judgment because you don't get to contest the figures that are forthcoming. So
we're going to have to relitigate that issue, and we're saying that's unfair. And number one, the big thing is she never asked for credit for those in the first place, so why are we doing an accounting on those?
That's your waiver argument.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, another thing, another issue on this is the actual assignment even valid? Okay, my client's saying that she never assigned these things. She never assigned it. The appellee is saying, oh, yes, she did. And that's basically all we've got. They actually provided an expert witness saying, yes, these are the signatures, but that's it.
All you've got is, I didn't sue it.
Exactly.
So why isn't it just a contested fact question and we give deference to the finder of fact?
I understand that. Here's my problem. There were problems with it, though. The name was signed with Jame rather than Jane. It looked different on the second signature than the first one. The appellee actually tried to suppress the second signature into evidence, which didn't make sense to me. And my whole thing is, why would she lie about it? If everything the appellee is saying is true, that she's paid all these back taxes since 1992 and actually there was an assignment, then she would have a wonderful lawsuit against my client. So why in the world would my client lie about that? So basically, what I'm asking for, Your Honor, is there is a difference. What we're talking about with the mandatory venue, I want to go back to that really quick.
You're saying your client is the one who said that the other person paid the taxes?
No. The appellee is saying that she's paid the taxes since 1992.
Right.
So why would my client lie and say, oh, no, I didn't ever assign it. I would actually owe half of those taxes as well. Okay, it doesn't make sense why she would lie about that to me anyways. It's something to think of. It's definitely not something I wanted to spend much time on, but that is definitely a question. But my whole thing, going back to the mandatory venue, it's not just title to land. We're not just talking about that. We're talking about who has an interest in the land. And I don't want it to be like, you can't hide behind the fact that this is a joint venture to get around the mandatory venue provision. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. Because we're talking about who has an interest in the land, and co-owners of a joint venture have an interest in that land. And that's all I have, so unless there are any questions, I'll waive the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Mr. Altman?
Thank you, Your Honor, Counsel. May it please the Court. Your Honors, the first issue, again, is venue that's been addressed. And one of the key things on the venue issue is the focus of the appellant has been on the narrow initial pleadings that were filed. And the Court's required to take a look at what the entire dispute was about. And it's very clear, even as today, as the appellant was describing what the dispute was about, we have a dispute between two sisters over control of a joint venture. It was triggered by a particular allegation, a particular outcry that began in Hemp Hill County. But even during trial, there were discussions about the Wyoming properties and earnings from the Wyoming properties. There's other properties. There were other debts that were incurred in connection with the other properties in other places. And Justice McCoy asked a question if there's been any other cases sort of on point, and there has been no reported cases. There was a unreported case, and there's a very the description of the case is very clear, but J.J.J. Walker, it was decided June 10th, 2010 by the Beaumont Court. In that case, the description of the facts is just the claims bought by relators tangentially concern hospital facilities located on real property in Jefferson County. But the essential dispute concerns the financial relationships of various corporations and the fiduciary duties arising out of those relationships. And that is 2010 Westlaw 2473832. Now, that's a mandamus case, so it was obviously decided on a different standard. It's unreported. It has properties in Wyoming, and that was discussed in connection in the record. It was on the first day of trial. I've got a note for that. 3 CR 191.
So what you're saying is that the ownership of the joint venture is disputed, and it contains more than just the Hemphill County property.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The ownership and the entire focus of the trial was on who owns the joint venture. As you observed, the title of this property in Hemphill County is not going to change based on the outcome of what the trial court judge did in this county one way or another. It was simply going to be a question of what were the net profit interest that Ms. Morris, the appellant, was going to be entitled to in the case. And when you look at the cases and you look at sort of, you start with Smith versus Hall, which concerns specific performance of a contract and focused on that distinction. But as you look at the KCS case and sort of its progeny to come from that, what you're seeing is they keep repeating the line that the court is not required to, quote, locate a survey, determine location of land, declare rights in real property or similar action tied directly to land. And that's the situation we have here. We have that repeated thing that we see in KCS and every case since then repeating that general outline. In order, and as a practical summary, if I was trying to do a black letter rule on this, if someone has to go out to the county clerk's office or get their hands dirty doing a survey or actually get out there and walk around the land and say, this is where the property boundary is, then you've got a dispute concerning real property. No, Your Honor, not in this. You would, if you were the trial court judge at the venue hearing, you would have to look at the four corners of the pleadings. But at this point in the process, after a jury trial or a bench trial, the standard review is all the pleadings on file. It's all the testimony that took place at the trial. So the court has a review, and that's set out in the Civil Practice and Remedy Code, Section 15064, Subsection B. That's the entire review. So we look at the entire case, and it's obvious, as has been stated, the battle for the joint venture, the battle over this contractual assignment, which the court found was the controlling document in this case below, is what we're here about. And it's not, and just because that falls in line and who owns that controls the property of Hemphill County, that tail can't wag the entire dog, so to speak, in this case.
Well,
Was there any evidence submitted, like copies of checks or division orders, to show how payments had been made over the past several years in regard to the mineral interest?
I think that was summarized by the accountant. I don't think that was an issue that was called attention to the trial court or that was particularly brought up.
Helen asked for an accounting in appellant's pleadings.
That is correct, and that was...
And the trial court, in response to appellant's pleadings, ordered an accounting.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the trial court also ordered that there will be no distribution of any profits to appellant until appellee had been reimbursed for taxes.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's
why that was litigated.
That was what was litigated, and that was put into dispute. Now, their argument is Ms. Fuller, the appellee in this case, did not put that before the court in her pleadings, and that's a fair criticism. Ms. Fuller, my client, was living happily. She assumed that, you know, she'd accumulated all this debt. It was going to take, you know, years and years to pay off the obligations that she was able to get this joint venture out from under, and that she was going to receive these payments. And that was the course of proceedings for approximately 12 to 15 years before this particular dispute arose. So her goal was just to simply get something to say, look, you're interfering with my contractual rights, stop that, to her sister. When Ms. Morris entered the lawsuit, she said, wait a minute, I want an accounting, I want to know when my interest is going to come to life. And that's what she signed on to. Now, these parties signed a very short assignment, and the trial court judge spent, you know, almost 2 days hearing evidence, reviewing this evidence, carefully reviewed it, prepared the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and basically gave the parties, in his estimation, in his judgment, what was in that agreement that they entered into. He gave force to that agreement, and where there were terms that may have been vague or potentially required collateral source because of their vagueness and ambiguity, he construed those terms, and he made a ruling on those issues. Now, that can't be easily upset. Now, their position is, well, that doesn't give us a final judgment. We don't have a clear final judgment. And the answer...
How are they supposed to contest the figures that you come up with in the future?
Your Honor, that is an issue that they asked for an accounting, they got an accounting, and...
Wait.
Okay.
They didn't get an accounting.
They're going to get an accounting, yes.
I know, but how did they dispute it? What's the judgment saying? This is Moses descending from the mountain.
And I think the issue on that is they did not ask for it to be reduced to a money judgment. They asked for an accounting.
Figures, but your client didn't provide.
Well, my client, there was testimony about what was owed and the amount that was owed. That was offered at trial. They had an opportunity to depose that witness.
If that was true, then he didn't need to do it this way.
Well, I think their complaint was that wasn't clear enough. They wanted – this is the relief they requested in our understanding of what they were looking for. They didn't request a money judgment or the date certain. They want to go back to a certain date.
Of course, they wanted an accounting so they can dispute it at trial.
Well, that's – that,
if they choose to.
If they choose to, yes, if they choose to. But what we have at this point is a judgment that gives effect to the party's intent of the contracts, and if they're unhappy with the accounting that's provided, they can come back and they can file a new action. That's their choice. But we have clear parameters now of what's required. It's tax accounting principles. She's going to set that information forward. And then if they're not happy with that, especially given, you know, if they think there's something worth litigating the issue over with in light of the court's clear ruling in the findings of fact, conclusions of law of how this is take place, they can make that decision to relitigate that or to initiate the litigation.
You can't go back into this lawsuit, do
it? No, I believe it would be a new lawsuit.
Final judgment. I mean, how do you procedurally do that? I don't see how that's possible. It's like me awarding you judgment and says the other side's going to pay all your future medical bills, whatever they may be. You just turn them in and they're going to pay it. Well, that's all you want to know.
And I think, Your Honor, that if there was a dispute saying I've been injured in a tort, please, you know, I'd like a judgment for my future medicals, we do reduce that. Absolutely, the judge in the tort case. In this case, though, I draw the distinction that we have a contract where that's specifically what the parties contemplated. They contemplated this sort of broad-ended agreement. Now, you know, it was a hastily drawn contract. Ms. Morris, the appellant, was trying to get out from this very looming, very large tax debt.
Okay. When your client comes in and says, well, the taxes that last year were $750,000, are you supposed to write a check because that's what you said they were?
Well, no, absolutely not, Your Honor. This would be if my client came in and fraudulently said $750,000, okay, and gave those numbers, and it wasn't done in accordance with tax accounting principles, then my client is guilty of fraud. She's guilty of fraud. Fraud's the obvious one that jumps to mind. She's guilty of misrepresentation. It's going to be a very easy lawsuit for her to go to court and say, Judge, you know, the original judge agreed that we should use tax accounting principles.
Just remanded to the trial court where there should be a trial of the numbers, if they choose to. I mean, I'm not saying that there's going to be anything wrong with it.
Right. Your Honor, I think in looking at this issue, that would the alternative would not be obviously render, as the appellant suggests in this issue. The issue would be a remand on that narrow issue of what are the damages, what's the date going forward, and I think that would be a very narrow issue for the trial court to decide. Yes.
Why don't you then address, now that we talk about render, address no pleading, no request?
Okay. Your Honor, the no pleading, no request is not the scope is not do we have to plead for a particular item. It's do the pleadings as a whole and do the issues tried before the court address those issues.
Okay.
The appellant asked for an accounting. The appellant said, give us an accounting, Ms. Fuller, of what you've been doing with the money. Tell us when I'm going to get our money back and what these terms of this contract mean. Now, we had to bog through a lot of other issues because there was issues of whether or not it was a contract or not or whether there had been a proper assignment. But what it got down to is, Ms. Morris pled for something, and she got it. Now, she wasn't Your Honor, that she got a accounting of this is where the money has gone. This is the accounting in general terms of there is a huge debt that's been incurred, and the trial court recognized that. That wasn't the accounting she wanted. She wanted an accounting that would have said, you know, this is the date, this is the amount of when things are going to get paid off. And the problem with that, I think, Your Honor, that the trial court wrestled with is with royalty payments and with deferring payments over time, you know, even if we have a certain amount, which was opined upon by Ms. Fuller's expert, how do you do that with oil and gas payments? Because they're going to be changing over time. So we know there's an amount certain. We didn't put it in the judgment. As I look at the judgment and consider that, you're absolutely right, Your Honor. But there is a number out there that we can work toward with the accounting, and based upon that, you know, you have to almost assume the royalty payments are going to be consistent.
Okay, now let's go to the 40%. When you read the assignment, doesn't the assignment itself appear to indicate an intent to return the parties to their original positions within the joint venture once the debt's been repaid?
No, Your Honor, because originally, if you looked at the original intent, each party had a 50-50 share. Okay, so if she was going to be returned to her original position, it would have said something like, in my opinion, it should have said assigners should be entitled to a 50% net profit interest in the joint venture. Okay, that would have returned him. That would have been very clear language, unambiguous, that returned her to her original position. When the parties put in the net profit in the properties conveyed, I think we agree and obviously argued to the trial court that the properties conveyed could have only been her 50% interest. Now, that is the one issue, I think, in the case that we don't have any issue of deference to the trial court. It's a de novo review. You three justices obviously have the ability to disagree with that construction of the contract. And that is probably a close issue in the case. I would acknowledge that. And I see I've got 2 minutes left. Let me just briefly address the forgery issue. Their argument is that there's a cursive, essentially boils down to there is a cursive N that could be interpreted as an M, and that's it. But Fuller came forward with expert testimony, which is alone sufficient to defeat in a criminal case. There was a defendant who was denying it. We cited that case in our brief. There were documents with exemplar signatures for the fact finder. The trial judge could compare them. There were notary verifications. In other words, we had two notaries out there that, you know, could have committed some crime and notarized if they were truly false notarizations. They were not presented. There was no evidence that contested. And finally, there's this entire testimony, Ms. Fuller, about what happened, going to the banks, getting these filed, clerk stamps. There was a long process, and there were documents that she was on notice of in a constructive sense that were filed down at the courthouse. And she did nothing for over a decade on these until we came to this position where she wanted to argue against it. So with that said, Your Honors, I think the forgery is sort of a red herring in this issue.
Was there evidence submitted as to why a second assignment was made? And it looks like maybe they're 4 years apart, one in 92 and then another one in 96.
No, that was one of the confusing issues because Ms. and I think that the probably had some of this trial court's decision is Ms. Morris, you know, does this and there's a second one. Why is it filed? She's not explaining why all this is done. She's just saying, oh, I never saw it, never saw any of this. And, you know, gosh, I don't know how it could have happened. I guess maybe there was some discussion about her husband at that time, Leet Jackson, who's now deceased, did a lot of her paperwork for her. And we, you know, I think during cross-examination we touched on some of the deposition testimony where she had said he did a lot of her paperwork. If there's no further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Altman. Rebuttal, Mr. Christensen.
Yes, Your
Honor. Really quick, Your Honors. The entire dispute, when we were talking about before with the Hemphill County, had properties also out in Wyoming and all of that, but the entire dispute here was the properties that were in Hemphill County. That's it, because the royalty payments, the initial one was against also Devon Energy, who are supposed to be paying out the royalty payments for the oil and gas leases out in Hemphill County, Texas. That was the original dispute between both Devon Energy and my client. And so all we're talking about here is the Hemphill County properties. Excuse me. So, Your Honors, for the standard of appellate review for this, in determining whether venue is proper or not, the appellate court shall consider the entire record, not just the pleadings or anything like that. It was the entire record. And so we're asking you to do that. Now, neither party actually asked for an accounting after the fact. We asked for the accounting right there during trial so we could deal with it right then. And also, more importantly, neither party asked for full credit for the payments back since 1992, the time of the assignment. And so we're not understanding why that was actually given. If like what you were saying, if no pleading, no request, that's exactly right. If they didn't ask for it, they shouldn't be given it. So we're wondering why they actually did get it. Now, another question was...
Let's say you asked for it.
We asked for it during the time of trial, Your Honor. We wanted it right then so we could handle it during trial so we could actually litigate it right then. But we did never asked for the appellee to get credit for all the payments she made since 1992. We never asked for that, obviously. We were asking for an accounting just to see what she has paid, but we never asked for her to get credit for it, neither did she. So we're wondering why the judge actually awarded that.
Well, but wouldn't that necessarily be a result of however the accounting comes out? I mean, it could have ended up, if you ever had an accounting, that she would get less as opposed to more.
It was never an issue, though, that was ever brought up, Your Honor. We weren't actually talking about how much money she would get because of all the money that she's paid. That was never an issue.
Well, aren't there procedures by which you can get pretrial accountings done and accomplished?
Your Honor, I don't know. All I know is that we did ask for an accounting. In fact, the judge also asked for an accounting before trial, and we never got it. That's all I know. And then I really don't understand why he gave her full credit for all of those things, even though she never asked for it. Now, another really big question was, why was it filed back in 1997 if it was also filed in 1992? Now, there's evidence in the record with the stamp on Hemphill County that goes along with other transactions that was happening with the appellee and her daughter with transfers there back and forth. And the funny thing is they happened, the stamp happened on the exact same day as the assignment, the second assignment, and it was also sequential, numbers were sequential, they were also in sequence, okay? So what's weird is the appellee is saying she had nothing to do with filing that second one, but it goes along with the other things that were happening with her daughter. So we're thinking that she actually did have something to do with that second one. We don't know enough about it, but there's definitely a lot of questions as to that is just doesn't seem right. Big question is, why was there a second one? If the first one was valid, there wouldn't be any need for a second one. But it all comes down to, for me, I understand, after talking with you, I can kind of see where I'm going with the venue thing, but that is the big one for us. We really feel like the law's on our side on that one, because the fact of the matter is, if you co-own a joint venture that owns land, then you have an interest in that land. And if there's an interest in the land, that's in the mandatory venue, and that's what we're asking for. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Mr. Altman, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. You all are excused.